Good morning, everybody. I believe we're live on Facebook now. Welcome to Notes on the Hill. My name is Mike Ryan, author of Nature Snowdonia. I provide CPD for mountain leaders, environmental training for mountaineering instructors. And you can find out more about that at my website, mikeryan.co.uk, where you can also buy my book, Nature Snowdonia. This is episode 10 of Upland Lives, a series where we talk to people who we share the uplands with, who have an interest in what goes on up there and look after it for us. Each of these interviews gets turned into a podcast, which you can download and listen to at your leisure afterwards. That's on Anchor FM. You'll find my channel there. If you subscribe to that, that'd be great. Now, I first met Dowie, this week's guest, a few years ago now, actually. He was senior warden with Snowdonia National Park, and he brought a team of very young, eager, enthusiastic wardens for some winter skills training when I used to work at Plaster Brennan. And we had a successful course, and Dowie and I hit it off very well, and we've looked for collaborations ever since, really, just trying to link those conservation worlds and the worlds of walkers and climbers, just trying to get things a little bit more seamless, a better understanding of what everybody's doing for everybody. And Dowie's one of those people who makes things happen. He has a really important role here in Snowdonia. We're going to talk about that today. But, you know, it's much bigger than that. It is about communicating with people. It is about enabling local people to take part in things. It's about improving access to the hills. And it's a whole wide range of things, as you'll find out when we talk to Dowie. So I'm really pleased to join Dowie, who is, and he'll probably correct me on this, is the project manager on the Upper Conwy River Basin Management Project. I know Dowie usually says it in Welsh, and I'll invite him to do that as well. But bon da, Dowie. Hello, I forgot my lines now. How are you today?
Thank you very much for that introduction. That's I've watched a couple of these going back now, and you're very good at you're very flattering with your introduction, so that did not disappoint.
Well, I need to put you at ease before I ask you some hard questions about
there we go.
So Upper Conwy River Basin Management Scheme, is that what it's called?
It trickles off the tongue, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. What is it? What is it all about?
So it's, we call it the Upper Conwy Catchment Project. So Project Dalgylch Uwch Conwy. So its main focus is looking at the river basin of Afon Conwy, looking at the tributaries upstream. So not just the, what we think of as Afon Conwy. We might think it starts in Llyn Conwy on the Mignaint and it ends up at Conwy. When you're a mountain person, as am I, and when you're high on the tops, you get that perspective. And actually, when you're looking down at the whole of that catchment, there's so many feeder sub catchments that come into the Conwy River. And by sort of Betws y Coed area, you've got 10 water bodies coming into the main river there. So and it drains a huge amount of upland. If you're standing on Moel Siabod, most of the rain that falls on you there, whichever way it goes, will go into either Nant y Gwrhyd or Lledr and eventually into Conwy. So, but it's not just about that sort of the river system itself. It's about the whole catchment approach. So we're looking at sort of land use all around the river and how that, how we manage not just water, but the nature of the land and the people that live there. So it's a sort of a multiple benefits approach that we're looking at. We're not looking at one aspect over the other at all. So, and when I say we, I talk about partnership quite a lot, but this is truly a partnership between National Trust, who I work for, and the Natural Resources Wales as well.
Yeah, I was going to just pick you up on that, because it is such an enormous area. I know you work for the National Trust, and the National Trust own a big chunk of that area, but you certainly don't own all that area, do you? So you're having to enter into partnerships to achieve the aims of the project.
Yeah, I think, I came into this job in 2015. It sort of attracted me from the start, really. And it was quite a serendipitous time, because we suddenly realised that, the work that we started in the National Trust, predating me back to 2007 or before then even, ditch blocking on the Mignites, you know, that had sort of, that was looking at a catchment scale around Llyn Conwy and around the actual Mignites area. But like I say, you know, we soon realised actually we can influence a lot of land ownership here and a lot of landowners to tackle some really tough issues and issues like you know, climate change. There we go, I've said it. It's pretty dominant, and it's going to dominate all of our lives increasingly, isn't it? So to get a real impact at scale, I think, you know, we needed to work with landowners and neighbours, and be they, you know, National Trust farm tenants or privately owned sort of estates or privately owned farms. It wasn't just about National Trust doing things on National Trust land with its tenants. It was about reaching out beyond boundaries, really. So at that time, NRW was quite fresh in its it was born in 2012, was it? A coming together of Forestry Commission and Environment Agency and the Old Countryside Council for Wales. So, you know, previously we'd have had to talk to all three of those organisations separately about similar issues that we were hoping to work on. But from that point onwards, we realised actually we can talk to one organisation about all these things. And I think, you know, locally, us approaching NRW actually helped them with some of those cultural sort of not misalignments, that's not fair to be, but they were coming from different places, weren't they? They had different remits, but we were able to use our project to sort of tackle all of those things and bring some of those legacy organizations together as well. So that worked well for NRW, I think, as well.
It's always going to be difficult amalgamating establishments and organizations, isn't it? And we all know it's difficult working in with establishments and organizations, so really good that this project has been one that's been able to cut through that and pull that resources, Wales together, work with the National Trust, work with local landowners, private and public. I'm just aware that's quite big, and I've probably got a couple of different groups of people listening in this week, Dowie. I've got the people who are the mountain leaders and want to know about the uplands, but I suspect few people have tuned in to understand more about the flooding and the flood management. I think the two go together. But before I get sort of delve into the detail of the project, can I just talk about you? So who are you to be doing what you're doing? How does Dowie Davis come to be managing the Upper Conwy Basin? You know, did you study hydrology at university? You know, how have you ended up
what
here?
On earth am I doing here? Why am I here? I often ask myself that question, but I think there's no short answer, I'm afraid to disappoint you. It all began, well, I was brought up in Llanfechan, so on the coast there, and you know, anyone who's sort of brought up in a place like Llanfechan has the benefit of the sea and the mountains in you know, within a couple of miles. So I was a really lucky sort of really lucky in my youth to be brought up there, and had a good group of friends, good people influencing me. You know, my dad dragged me up the hills from an early age, so eventually had to stop dragging me, so that obviously worked. But yeah, surrounded by farmers, surrounded by the Welsh language, and the community of Llanfechan and Snowdonia. So schooled in Bangor, educated, went off to Sheffield then, did my degree in environmental geology in Sheffield. The attraction was sort of three things, the degree itself, the interest in the environment, and also in landforms, I guess, and also the Peak District's proximity, and the fact, the third thing that were, you know, that Sheffield has its share of breweries and pubs, so that sort of grabbed my attention.
A fine city.
Yeah, it's a lovely place. So following on from that, really, I came back to Bangor, did a year of countryside management with Geraint George. I don't know if you remember Geraint George, teacher.
And then was in the beginning.
Yeah. So he was a big influence on my life, actually, at that time as well. And then, yeah, from that point, I became a little bit itchy feet. I had a bit of wanderlust, so I wanted to see a bit more of the world. So From that point, I went on to New Zealand and worked a bit with Departments of Conservation over there. So had a lot of, not just experience, but perspective on how, because there they do it slightly differently to us. There's fewer people there, for one thing. They've still got farming, you know, it's a big part of their culture. They've got the Maori culture as well, so parallels with Wales in that way as well. And then, yeah, just the way they tackled some of their issues was, you know, they have one Department of Conservation. So that sort of, when you're dealing with a big organisation now like NRW, it does sort of remind you actually there are other places with that similar model going on. So, that was all sorts of exciting things like radio collaring kiwis and the bird, not the fruit or the person. And then helicoptering in and out of all these amazing places in South Island, New Zealand. So it's good times there.
Good experience.
I came back then and started my own contracting business, stone walling and upland footpath work as well. So stone pitching and not just pitching, but rhododendron control as well.
Okay.
We all love rhododendron, don't we? So I spent a good 2 years of my life bashing that plant to kingdom come, really. So that gave me a lot of experience in Snowdonia again, and I kind of put down roots again. I think the wanderlust never leaves you, do you? You still crave New Zealand, especially these
nice
days.
It's nice to travel. But just on top of that there, you've walked the walk, as it were. You know, you're now in senior management, but you have built paths and walls and cut down rhododendrons. So you really understand what it's like at the sharp end there.
I hope so, yeah. I've got the backache to pay for, you know, to show for it. But, people used to ask me, you can't do this forever. And I said, I have no intention of doing this forever. You know, when I'm soaked to the skin and up to my waist in mud on the hillside, which, you know, sounds horrible, but actually it's quite enjoyable at times, weirdly. About 10 years of doing that. And then we had the kids came along, didn't they? So, I had to get a proper job then. Decided that now is the time for change, and I opted for a year of postgrad teacher training. I thought that'll get me back into get my brain engaged again in civilization, I suppose. So I did geography for secondary geography in Aberystwyth, and then I quickly realised that indoor classroom teaching wasn't for me really. So. I'm an outdoor person, and anyone who's been in a meeting with me for more than 2 hours will know that. I get a bit angsty. Yeah. And then that Comidwell job appeared in the newspaper, and I thought, hang on, what's this now? This is looking for somebody with a lot of countryside skills, knowledge of the outdoors, but also with a teaching remit as well, or an education remit, certainly. I thought, well, I'll go with that. It was, I don't know if you remember, it was 2009 or 2010,
I think. Comidwell is an interesting case study for when we talk about land designations. So we would take a group of mountain leaders and we'd say, this is owned by the National Trust, managed by NRW because it's a SSSI and an SAC and an SPA and a Ramsar, and oh, it's also in the National Park, we'll also manage it, and there's a farmer trying to farm it. So how, you know, that was all a bit messy, wasn't it? Presumably was your role to tidy that up and get all those people working together?
Yeah, I mean, I used to say it was the most heavily designated, you know, 1,000 acres of land anywhere in the country. I'm not sure if that's true, but it's got all sorts of designations, as you say, and rightly so. It's an amazing place. And I had to do that job to remind myself what kind of special place it was, really.
Yeah, very special.
Because I've been there, obviously, as growing up and as a child, you know, for walks and that kind of thing, and I knew about the climbing, I knew about some of the wildlife there, but I'd never actually looked, I never scraped the surface and got into the geology of the place. So it took me going away to Sheffield to do a degree in geology to come back and actually notice what I was or realize what I was looking for.
Yeah,
so that you know, I really got my teeth stuck into that job. I really enjoyed I wasn't there for long. I was there for a couple of years, tops really. And then the National Park job was advertised, so the senior warden for the north of Park Eryri. So, and I managed to land that one. So, yeah, and I was there until this job, really. So,
Hang on a minute. You set
I told
up
you it wasn't going to be a short story.
No, you set up the Comedible Partnership, yeah. Got that working. So there was one officer managing all the various interests, yeah?
Yeah.
And then you moved
I didn't set it up. I took the job. It was already, to be fair, there was lots of people working together to set it up. So had been a partnership before I came along between National Trust, who owned the land, Countryside Council for Wales at the time, who managed the nature reserve, and then obviously the access and surrounding areas, the infrastructure below is all owned and managed by the park. So there are varying perceptions that I'm sure you found, you know, when you go up there with a group or with clients, that you ask them who owns this land and they'll have all sorts of ideas. Mostly they'll say Snowdonia National Park own this land. Well, in actual fact, it's the building down below, the toilets, the car park, and you know, critically, they do manage the access, and they have a really strong role to play there. But there are other people involved there as well, and I think it was the foot and mouth crisis, 2001, that finally brought out the sort of realization that hang on, there's three organisations here that are all turning up and not really joined up in a joined up way. So that was part of that role, was to make sure that there was one person or one partnership representing it also. And at the time there was the new building there as well that was being constructed, so that was very exciting times.
Yeah, that's interesting. I know we'll come back to Idwell and Ogwen in particular, because now you've gone off to the National Park, haven't you, to manage the wardens or be a senior warden. What was that role?
Yeah, so that was a tough job, I'll be honest. It was, on paper, it's a dream job, and I actually said it was a dream job on a couple of interviews. So, and it was, but there were aspects of it that were just really tough. You're dealing with you're caught between a rock and a hard place more often than not. Everyone, people care about Snowdonia, but they really care about Snowdon. And Snowdon tended to sort of just sucks you in, I was supposed to cover the whole of the north of the park. I never really felt that I got to that the scale of the job proper until I was able to at least partly hand over Snowdon to Helen Pye, Helen came along, thank goodness, and took the bull by the horns on Snowdon and carried on there, really. So it wasn't, I say it's a tough job. It was a wonderful job. Good people, good team of people there as well. And good, I hate the word stakeholders, but, the people that you work with around you were really good. Yourself, Mike, I had lots of support from people, really. And it's kind of you're a figurehead in that job. People look at you and you represent the national park. So, if they've had an issue with planning, or been turned down for something, or if they've got issues with an organised event passing their back garden or whatever, you cop it, or you're expected to fix it. So and then even things like when an avalanche happens on Snowdon, we were even blamed for some of that. Hang on, it was a tough time, but I think there was it was transition time as well. I think. The Park Warden Service had been associated, and rightly so, with Mountain Rescue in a big way back in the 80s, 90s. And that was, the authority was trying to move away from that, really. There are Mountain Rescue teams out there, thankfully, dealing with that that side of things. But, the park's role was more to do with messaging and education. So to, the sort of prevention side of it, and we had a group of people called Mountain Safe, which included National Park officers and wardens and mountain rescue teams, and Martin Doyle as well at the time from Plasabrenning.
Yeah,
as well.
Yeah, so, we had a few of those as well.
Yeah.
Plasabrenning, BMC,
we got involved. That's it, yeah. So, it was... I think, you know, at the time I remember talking to Helen, and you know, we were deciding what it needs really to manage the place. And Snowdon, like a lot of places, had had management plans drawn up, probably by the people, the practitioners, you know, the professionals working on the hill, but with very, not little regard, but very sort of minimal involvement or input from the users and the people, you know, the residents and the people who live there. And I think, you know, that was something that Helen had picked up on in the Brecon Beacons, where she'd come from, that there was an approach there that needed to be taken. And God, my gosh, she really has taken that approach and done it well, I think.
I think so.
The team, you know, it's a team effort always, isn't it? But you need somebody to push the boundaries of it and to try new approaches.
It's not an easily issue to solve, Snowdon, and the Snowdon Partnership's been set up to move things forward. But and as you say, you know, the National Park's another institution. They've had funding cuts in recent years. You know, it's been a really difficult time for anybody involved in that world. And it kind of seems ironic that now what we all need to be doing is being outside, going for a walk to get healthier and breathe some fresh air. It seems to me like those areas should be receiving the maximum possible investment they can get. But that may be our personal viewpoint. Other people think we need more roads and railways.
Yeah, I think that, you know, this whole pandemic has really, you know, shown to more people, should we say. I think a lot of us knew it anyway. You know, I've been fortunate being brought up, but, you know, very little of my education involved going out to these places and doing, you know, I had some Glanllyn with the Earth and that kind of thing. But had I not been doing it myself with my mates and my dad, I don't think I'd have been, you know, in that position now. If I was born in a city, there's nothing to say that I wouldn't, you know, I'd be doing what I'm doing now. So I think, you know, we're doing the younger generation, or the youth of today, if you want to call them that, a disservice, really. There's been an awful lot of cutbacks of funding for, you know, mountain centres or even outdoor centres in Snowdonia over the last 15, 20 years, really. Yeah. I know, you know, I observed it when I was in the park and previous to that as well. There was a trend of just cutting back on all of these places. Thankfully, you've still kept on to place, you know, people like ourselves with Ogwen Cottage, and in partnership with Outward Bound Trust, you know, they're still pushing at this. And and to be honest with you, I think they should be people should be throwing money at places like that now to get these kids out there again, because, you know, up until the pandemic, I think there was a realization that we were losing contact or connection with nature. But I think this has really shown that actually we need it for so many reasons. We need the outdoors. So, let's hope that things can change after this. As we rebuild, cool kids and the younger generation can have those opportunities.
Very quick to throw our arms up in the air when people come out of the countryside and don't behave in an appropriate manner. But if we are reducing investment and opportunity for those people to come out and enjoy the countryside in a responsible way, then that's what happens. It really does need some looking at from government, I think, in Wales and in England, really. It always seems a bit higher on the agenda in Scotland, doesn't it? It seems like the Scottish government actually realise people go hill walking and climbing, whereas in England, Wales, it's sort of a hidden secret society almost, isn't it?
Yeah, it is a little bit, two different worlds somehow, isn't it? But I think, you know, that you can give people the experience, or give young people the experiences of the outdoors. But what we've tried to do, for example, in Ogwen, sorry if I'm jumping your question line here.
Right, let's just tidy that up. So you came from the National Park back to the National Trust. One of the things you had to manage was the Ogwen Cottage situation.
The project really that we had there. So Birmingham Council, who ran Ogwen Cottage for decades, really,
50 years had,
they were selling. So we thought, well, actually this is an opportunity for the National Trust, who in actual fact, apart from a couple of other landowners in the Ogwen area there, they're the predominant landowners. And we just thought we were missing the trick, really, in terms of visibility of, you know, all the work the Trust's been doing, the Ranger teams there for years, not being seen, really. So we thought, right, that's one thing that would be an advantage to be based at Ogwen Cottage for. But then we thought, actually, we need to, we've got a purpose here to, you know, the core purpose of the Trust is, you know, conservation, but also bringing people along and young people. And it just made sense for us when we thought, right, if we got Ogwen, what would we do with it? So we quickly realized that we perhaps weren't the best people to be delivering those experiences, because there were other partners out there that were set up for that, namely Outward Bound Trust. So we had some really interesting conversations with them early on and exploring what we could do there. And I think it's fair to say that, you know, it's not just about the outdoor pursuits side of things with Ogwen Cottage and the experience that the young people have when they come there. Partly due to the Outward Bound Trust, but also the National Trust Ranger team, we've worked really closely with the Outward Bound instructors to offer an adventure, sort of learning through adventure. So it's connecting young people. It's not just, as I say, dangling them off a cliff and terrifying them into loving the place. It's, you know, you get them to go out on an expedition where they would perhaps plant trees at the end of it, or they'd do some roadie bashing, so they're, or litter picking, or any, you know, footpath maintenance. So they give something back as well. And, you know, the feedback you get from those weeks where that's happened has been, just really, it's kind of makes you feel quite emotional when you're reading it back, you know. And there's been some video sort of testimonials from some GCSE pupils from Great Barr in Birmingham or whatever. And they're talking about Snowdonia like they've fallen in love with a place and they realise that they're suddenly part of this planet. And so it's a heck of a powerful thing, you know. You can do that in 5 days. So it's I think it just needs to happen.
What you're doing there is connecting people to that environment, isn't it? They're not coming and just dancing on top of it. They're getting their hands dirty, getting involved and getting to understand it. That's been a big role of yours with the National Park, hasn't it, to get people involved? Sorry, and the National Trust, to get people involved in these projects.
Yeah, in both, really. I think ignore the people at your peril is the key thing. So, and to turn that around, you know, you have to involve people. I think a good example when we've been doing some of the big sort of engineering river restoration works in places like Cwmpe Machno, for one place, you know, we were able to do an awful lot of the work there without people stopping. This was in the middle of January, you know, it's really quiet there. And if anything happens, people want to know generally, but nobody stopped because, frankly, they all knew about it. We'd already engaged in conversations with people there and they got what we were up to. You know, we had some interesting conversations. Not everyone supported what we were thinking and what we were doing. But I think, you know, that's part of the solution, really, isn't it? So you have to have those challenging, difficult conversations with people. And when you sort of scrape the surface a little bit, you realize that actually a lot of people are anti something, either through they don't understand it because it's not their world, or they feel threatened, which is it's a threat to the status quo, to something they've always regarded as being, well, it's always been like that, so don't touch it. And then it's only through those conversations you can sort of persuade or talk them through, actually it hasn't always been like this. You will remember that it's been like this because you've lived at a time when it was. But if you go back far enough, you'll know that, you know, classic example is conifer plantations, you know, in Cwmpe Machno. People saying there when we first arrived and we were talking about we're going to fell these trees in succession, you know, with NRW, but we're going to replant with a mixed sort of native native species. So and then people were up in arms, you know, some people, they were saying, well, actually, you know, this is an alpine forest, you know, how dare you come here and break this pristine environment. And we say, hang on, no, you know. And some of the other people, you know, it wasn't just us saying these things, which is helpful. Some of the other people who'd lived there for longer were saying, actually, I remember these trees being planted. This is a plantation, you know, this is this isn't pristine alpine wilderness we're talking about here. This is a man-made environment, if you like. So, but without having those conversations, people, you can't teach people, can you, I suppose?
You can't. It's really hard. There's quite a bit of that felling going on at the moment, and I think the NRW are trying to let some natural regeneration take place, which is lovely. Let's come on to the Conwy project then. So from the National Trust point of view, it starts on the Mignant, and your first job up there was to block up drainage ditches. So why? Surely if it drains off, that's got to be better.
Well, that was the thinking about a century ago, to be fair, yeah. And also about half a century. So it used to be owned by the Penryn Estate, the Mignant, so they had an awful lot of land ownership. And it came to the National Trust in the same way that the Carneddau and Gladerau Estate came to the National Trust from Penryn Estate. And it had basically been drained by gamekeepers to improve the grouse shooting. So that was the initial sort of aim of all that, all those drains going in. I think to improve farm animal or farm grazing up on the Mignant, it was further drained in the 60s and 70s, and I think supported as well by agricultural grants to do that. Yeah, so
there was government funding to do that sort of thing at that time.
Yeah. And it was it's improving land, you know, that word improving has to be used very carefully, and we look at it differently these days, don't we? But improving for agriculture was a really important thing to do. Yeah. And I think, you know, since then we've realised, well, actually, how much have these drains improved places like the Mignant for grazing? And to be honest with you, when the grip blocking started in 2007, there was a lot of skepticism from not just farmers but people who had, it's always been like that phrase again.
Yes. People, change is a difficult thing, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, isn't it? So you know, there was the phrase, you're creating paddy fields, was once used, I think, up on the Mignant there. I think it made the Daily Post at one point. But yeah, slowly but surely, you get people to realise actually there's another function, there's another use to this land, or there are other uses and functions to this land. And if you're only doing it for the sake of one thing, one product, i.e., meat, wool, for farming, then you might be missing the trick in other ways. And initially, the grip blocking all started to capture or recapture the carbon to repair the blanket bog. To trap the carbon, because it's a fantastic carbon store. It's a sequester of carbon. Yeah. So it draws carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere and stores it in peat. Yeah. So that was the number one reason initially, and also for habitat. So you've got amazing species up there, really scarce these days, hen harrier, golden plover, dunlin. So, you know, a lot of these species are sort of hanging on in there in places. So we needed to re-wet the bog, really, for those things. And then as a bit of a byproduct, I think we realized that actually by blocking in these ditches, we're slowing the flow of water as well from here. So when it, you know, when there's an incredible downpour, and it does rain on the Mignant, I've been told, if you've ever been there, take a coat. There were some interesting byproducts that came from that then. So that we didn't expect, really, or we were, it wasn't the driver behind the doing initially. So it was just, it doesn't flood as much as it used to now.
So Dowie, Mignant's been going on for a wee while now, hasn't it? Presumably you've had to measure the impacts and do species studies and all that sort of thing. And then what you're saying is it was a byproduct where people realise it actually could assist with the flood management. That's amazing, isn't it? Have you seen changes in the wildlife up there? Have you seen changes in the bird populations?
I think it's to be honest, there are other factors when it comes to birds. It's not a sort of a stagnant species. They move, and there are factors from elsewhere that might affect populations. So I think what we've done is to improve the habitat of the Mignant for those species. But if you're talking animals that can go elsewhere, then they can be at risk elsewhere as well. from a vegetation point of view, a lot of the work, you know, the, and the hydrology point of view, there's been some great improvement there. We do have monitoring. Well, I think it's one of the, it's like Cwmydwell in a sense. It's so heavily designated and so heavily studied by everyone, really. You know, it's bound to show positives after all the work that's happened there. There's something like 400 kilometers of ditches have been blocked now in that time. So, interestingly, the flooding angle, we didn't really monitor for that. We didn't measure, we didn't baseline for that, because the only flood monitoring station is further downstream, which by which point, you know, you've got all the tributaries running into to Avon Conwy, so hard to measure the effect in that one subcatchment. But when the Environment Agency flood line used to alert landowners that they're, you know, move your sheep off a piece of land that normally floods, you know, anecdotally, we had people, the farmers up in places like Sputty Ivan saying, well, I've had the phone call, but there's been no flooding. So what's going on here? I think that's actually more powerful than any sort of report written on the back of it, really, you know, that people affected by it are no longer affected. Really, so.
Really is, because those communities talk to each other a lot, don't they, about what you were doing up on that moor. Just stick with the Mignon for a little bit for another question. What you're doing up there sounds a bit like rewilding or nature friendly or that sort of thing. What should it look like up there if it were left to its own devices before people had come? And is that something that's beginning to return up there?
I will answer the question I wish you'd have asked me, as opposed to the one you asked me, if that's okay. It's not rewilding. And I think we don't live in a world without people. You know, we haven't ever, but you know what I'm saying? The Mignent has never been without people. So I, you know, you can talk about the natural succession and what it could be if you strip the whole place of everything that grazes, but actually in a natural setting, you would have grazing, you'd have grazing animals. So I don't think it's fair to say, yes, you can fence any block of land off and keep all animals out and it would become scrubbed up and woodland and, I don't think it's not a good thing, because like I say, in a natural setting, it would have been grazed and browsed by herbivores. So, you know, the work we've done on the Mignent has only been possible with our tenants supporting us. And I go back to 2007, the beginnings of ditch blocking. You know, one of the first things that we found out was when you open up a ditch over time, so if it's sort of in profile, over time the vegetation will grow over the top and it'll become piped. So you don't see that there's a ditch there eventually. After a few years, it will have overgrown it on the top. But the water's still going, still eroding and still doing damage. So, but what else happens is that the sheep and the animals that are grazing up there will get caught in those pipes and, you know, they'll die basically in within those ditches and nobody will know. So, you know, there's a bit of a lesson there as well in terms of the harm that ditches can do. And I think, you know, by now we've got farmers who are actually coming to us and asking us and NRW and, you know, the people who would consent any sort of grip blocking work. They're asking us, can we do this here as part of our farm business model? So it's completely flipped on its head. You know, the culture there is so such a healthy one. I think we've, you know, it's a mutual support culture. And I'm not just saying that because it sounds good to, you know, to my bosses or anything. It genuinely is. You know, there's a cooperative of farmers up there called Ferm Ivan, and they, you know, we've helped them, they've helped us, and it's just we're helping each other to deliver something that suits all of us, really. So it's bringing money into the area, livelihoods, which in turn, you know, helps conserve the culture as well. But it's also delivering flood alleviation, carbon sequestration, connecting habitats, improved habitats, water quality, all those benefits. They're all, it's so, just a win-win-win.
That's going really well, which is fantastic. And there's models there that other people can follow, aren't there? From the Mignon, you've sort of taken a wider drainage basin view now. I mean, I can look out my window and I can tell you there's still some flooding on the Knight Conway floodplain. Only a little bit, but there is some flooding there. So what else have you done in the drainage basin, or what are you trying to do to help with the flood management of the Conway Valley?
Well, a whole host of things, really. You know, not one thing in each place, really. It's a multitude of things. So, for example, when you're looking at such a big catchment, you've got to sort of zoom in and focus when you're doing a piece of work. So we've done some work in Cwmpamachnow, which I mentioned, on river restoration. So reconnecting the river, taking away old embankments, reconnecting the river with its floodplain. We've done similar work in Nantagwrydd up from Capel Curig. And that's been really, in a different way. We've basically applied our knowledge from what we've learnt in Cwmpamachnow as well to what could work in Nantagwrydd. So we've done in-river works, which enables the water to, leave the main channel and get out onto the floodplain again. But we've also done things like fencing some of the tributaries coming into the main river and planting them up with trees. And planting the riverbanks as well. So that has a lot of benefits, not just in terms of, you know, those trees will grow, they'll provide stability for the riverbank, therefore reducing erosion, but they'll also, you know, they'll provide shade for the fish as well, so that regulates the water temperature in the river. So
just so people listening know where you are now, that's between Plasterbrenin and Penygwryd, isn't it? So the farm, Burbank Farm, I bought a mountain farm, that is a National Trust farm. It's still a sheep farm, isn't it? It's still a working sheep farm. But within that context, you're fencing off the gullies and letting the trees grow. This is where you're doing the sabre planting as well, isn't it?
Yeah, so...
sabre planting is.
It's a cool word, and it's a cool phrase. I think, you know, you don't always want to see fences going up, do you, in the landscape? It's a necessary evil. And it's basically to keep grazing out while any trees that you planted get away, really, and get ahead. Sabre planting offers an alternative in some places where it can work. So you plant the tree at an angle coming out of a riverbank that means that grazing animals can't actually get to the leading tip, sort of the growing part of the tree. And it grows in a kind of a sabre shape then. So it sort of starts growing out horizontally almost, and then it grows vertically, so it forms this sort of sabre shape. So the phrase sabre planting is a really sort of catchy one, isn't it? But it does mean sort of fenceless planting, really. That's what it enables. So
moving on from there, I mean, again, I look out the window here, I can see you just talked about removing some flood banks, presumably some others have gone in other places, but it's reconnecting the river with its floodplain, because rivers do flood and they always will flood, won't they? One of the things that comes up down here around Trevorrow and Llanrwst is dredging the river. Some people think if you dredge the river, the water will go away quicker. I think somebody else said the river was dredged when the boat, because Trevorrow was a port, wasn't it? Boats. Yeah. So the dredging was to do with that. Is dredging part of that matrix, or is that a bit of a red herring?
I'll try and answer that question, but because I deal with upland sort of issues, it's hard for me to comment on such a big contentious issue as well, isn't it, dredging? But from my point of view, I think if you can avoid dredging, you should, because of the ecological impact on the actual the habitats within the river, and it's tidal there, isn't it, as well, where you're talking. So
it is.
What we've seen in places like in Cwmpamachnow, effectively, they weren't per se building flood banks to stop the river leaving the river, although that was a kind of an added bonus. The rivers were dredged, so they were, you know, and the same in Dyffrymwmbyr, they have been sort of line dredged or whatever you want to call it, you know, back in to dry off the land, the surrounding land, for improved grazing. In a nutshell. So people think of floodplains as well. And I know, granted, you're looking down at a pretty decent lowland floodplain there, but floodplains occur in the uplands as well. And that's the kind of the point of our work, is that we're looking at places in the uplands that can hold back that water for a little bit longer. We store it. That's not to say we're re-wetting or creating lakes, reservoirs, bogs, whatever. What we're doing is allowing that natural process to happen so that water can be delayed. So I hate the phrase, but I'm going to use it. Flatten the curve, Mike. You know,
the hydrograph.
Yeah, the hydrograph curve in this sense. So if you look at the flood peak, people talk about the peak, don't they? And basically, it's that peak that's always the worry when you own a property in an area that's susceptible to flooding. But if we can sort of keep that water back for longer, we can flatten that curve. That's a very simple way of putting it. But that's the aim, I think.
Yeah, and you've been modelling this, haven't you, on Carrog Farm in Pamachno Valley there, which is a National Trust farm now, isn't it? And that was what we'd call a canalised river. That was quite heavily dredged. The bank was building up at the side. So what have you done on the Carrog Farm that models this more naturalistic way of managing the drainage patterns?
For Carrog, we had... So the gravel embankments, the gravel that had been dredged out historically, and periodically as well. It wasn't just a one hit dredge. It was a continuous sort of process of diggers going in there and even a bulldozer at one point, I think, was tracking up Avon Machnon, ploughing all this river to create, as you say, it's a canalised river. You know, it's square in profile, isn't it? And that just, you know, it works. It's working against a process which is natural. The river wants to meander. It wants to burst its banks, and it wants to then, you know, that floodwater wants to then come in when it's able to. So, I think there's a lot of opportunity we're demonstrating in the Uwch Conwy catchment. You look across any upland environment, anywhere upstream from where there's horrendous flooding happening. There are things that people can do, or organisations or partnerships. We can look at catchment management as a way of holding back the floodwaters as long as we can. That's not going to stop flooding. That's the key point here. And flooding has also become more of an issue with climate change. So you've got, it's a kind of a shifting baseline, isn't it? Had we done this work in the 80s, 90s, you would have seen instant benefits, perhaps, and you could, you know, measurable benefits. We're now looking at rainfall events that are, you know, more severe, more prolonged, more often, and more intense when they happen. So we're almost just playing catch up with that moving feast, really. So it's really hard to model, therefore, and to demonstrate the benefits of what we're doing. So we don't hang our sort of hat on the hook of we're fixing flooding here. We're not entirely fixing it, but we're not only fixing it, we're improving habitats, soil carbon and all of this, and enabling people to farm as well. So
there are lots of components to managing a flood basin, and there's lots of components to flooding itself, and we're not going to be able to fix global warming through your project. One of the areas I'm quite interested in there, though, Dewey, is that floodplain in the uplands is often quite a precious bit of land for grazing, isn't it? It's one of the best bits of land on the farm. And over the generations, some farmers work really hard to move away from the sort of old-fashioned hay meadows and to stop it getting boggy as much as they can, because that's their best bit of land for fattening their stock up. How do you cope with that? Is it a dichotomy? You know, that's we need it to flood, but they need it for to make a living on. How do you manage that situation?
I think it is that's the tricky part of this sort of moving forward of how we manage land, really. I think there's a function to land, as I mentioned earlier. There are many functions to land, so if you're looking at the best field, sometimes, as you say, then maybe it should stay the best field. There are other places in the catchment, which is a benefit of working at scale like this. There are plenty of places we can do what we're talking about here with reconnecting floodplains to river channels. So You know, if it really is a key element to somebody's farm business model, then, you know, it's not something we would want to mess with, really. And it's, you can only do that on a case by case basis, I think. Maybe in time, as, you know, subsidies change and farm support payments change, that can be sort of reflected in how farmers are rewarded for, you know, allowing parts of their land to be flooded when at times of flood, that kind of thing. That's something, it's almost takes it to policy level. Yeah. We can demonstrate what's possible, and it's up to sort of policymakers then to decide, right, how are we going to support this if we think it's a good thing. So
that's really interesting. So it's not an either or model, is it? It's some places will keep that meadow, other places will lose that meadow. I know there was one at Capycurig we were looking at where there was no need for the flood defence to be there anymore. You could remove it and let that meadow flood. Yeah. And by that meadow flooding, you'd protect some meadows on the other side of the river, give them a longer flood-free period. So
it's exactly that. Exactly that. So you have to look at what you've got in the context. So, you know, going back to, again, you and I are people who are used to standing on top of things, looking down. So you can do that at landscape scale. You can look at that side of the river actually would be better as a reconnected floodplain. That one, it doesn't actually, you know, the opportunity isn't there for whatever reason. That can be that the landowner or the farmer isn't up for it. He wants that, or she wants that, and that's fine, you know, but we do what we can where we can, I think. And that's the key thing, is to have those conversations with people. And more often than not, you are pleasantly surprised with what people actually want. You can listen to people going on the media about all sorts of, oh, this is the stance of farmers, but actually, you know, it's more often not. When you have those one-to-one or small group conversations with farmers, there's a lot of them saying, I want more trees on my land. I want them in the right places, but I want more. I like trees, you know, so or whatever. That's just one example. So
no, there is an awakening there of that greater landscape management. I think James Rebank, I know it's called English Pastoral, but some of the concepts he's talking about in his new book are about farmers re-engaging with the land and realizing that there may be some of the old ways weren't such bad ways. They were good ways, and they should.
Yeah, it's just re-finding that balance, I think, isn't it? We've got the pendulum swung too far one way. And, you know, I think a lot of your speakers have said, you know, it's not, please don't blame the farmers. And I echo that, because it's policy. And policy for such a long time, it's created a culture and a mindset. And you've got to have patience, because people, you know, if I owned a farm, I wouldn't want to reconnect the river with its floodplain if that was my best silage field.
Yeah.
You know, because my dad and my tithe or whoever had battled to get that farm into that condition. So you've got to be really careful and sensitive to that, I think.
I think so. I think that's great. And you actually sound really positive and optimistic about the project as well. It's going well. Where's it going to go? When's it finished?
Well, as we keep saying, you know, today it will come with tomorrow the world. So I don't think it will finish. Is the truth there? I think we carry on doing what we can where we can. It's a lot of work, actually. There's a lot of you know, delivery on the ground, and I heavily rely on other people to do my job with me, for me sometimes, and I won't start naming them, because there's dozens, if not, you know, hundreds. But it takes an awful lot of people to get things happening in the countryside. You know, it's not just you casually look out at a landscape and you think, oh yeah, not much goes on there, but you'd be really surprised, wouldn't you?
We're really surprised. Dowie, I think that's been fantastic. I think you've given people a really good overview of the project, and also found out a little bit more about how you come to be working in this environment, which has been a great story. So I'm going to leave it there, if that's okay. Thank you very much. Is there anything else you wanted to add just before we do finish?
No, just thanks for the opportunity, really. It's good to get the message out there. I've really enjoyed these. I've been watching them back, so yeah, thanks.
Brilliant. See you soon. Thank you. Next week we're not with the National Trust, we're with the National Park. We're on the Carnedhai project. So it's another massive landscape project that's taking place here in Snowdonia, and one that I think walkers and climbers and mountain leaders and mountaineer instructors should really be aware of and engage with. And we've got the project manager for that, Dr. Marion Pye, we'll be talking to you next Wednesday. So if you're listening and you've enjoyed it, please join us next week and click all the likes and the subscribes and any of those sort of things. That's really helpful. So Jochen Vauerdaoui, we're going to close the meeting now, and that'll be it. Thank you.
Jochen Vauer.
I'm still here because I can't work out how to close the meeting. Sorry about that.